You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
It's been around 18 months since ACT Party leader David Seymour's end-of-life choice bill was first drawn from the ballot. Since then, it's faced a tidal wave of opposition at the select committee stage, strong support from the public at large, and it's just passed its second reading in the House with 50 votes against and 74. So, where to from now? Well, the bill will face its final hurdle in the Committee of the Whole House debate, but with many MPs preparing amendments to the bill, what is its chance of passing? I spoke with David Seymour this morning and started by asking him whether he was pleased with how the votes went in the House last week.
Yeah, look, the 10-vote margin to get 70-50 over the line, so that's really helpful because it means that clearly there's some momentum and, you know, even if a few people change their mind in the later stages, there's still a very strong chance that we'll go through with a majority.
A lot of MPs voted for the second reading with the caveat that they wanted some changes made during the next stage of the debate process. There's been those talks of 120 amendments proposed and that sort of thing. How are you going to be able to please everyone to make sure you get those votes?
Well, first of all, the changes that are desired are pretty straightforward, and I actually signalled what I thought they should be as early as December when I put out a sponsor's report, a summary of submissions that were made by the public to the Select Committee and how I thought Parliament should respond to the public submissions. So this is a process that's been coming for a long time. One of the biggest changes we're going to propose is that currently the bill says you can access assisted dying if you have a grievous and irremediable condition. Now, it's a bit of a mouthful. It comes out of Canadian case law. People have argued a lot about what that means. I'm pretty clear about what it means, and so are the Canadian courts. But people have said, look, we'll only vote for this if you make it much simpler and say that a person has to have a condition that is likely to end their lives within 6 months, i.e. a terminal illness. So that's going to narrow the provisions. It's going to mean that some people who have, you know, quite terrible illnesses, neurodegenerative diseases such as Huntington's, won't be able to access assisted dying the way that they'd like to and the way I originally intended. But it does make the bill simpler and clearer and will, I believe, maintain the support of a majority in Parliament to get it through. When you talk about there's going to be 120 amendments, I mean, yeah, people who are opposed to this bill, no matter what form it takes, we'll put up all sorts of amendments to try and divide the coalition who are in favour of choice and compassion. They'll try and delay the debate by putting up amendments. But look, the rules of our parliament actually make it quite difficult to waste parliament's time. In the United States, you know, some guy puts a catheter in, stands at his desk and reads the telephone book for 24 hours to try and delay progress in the House of the United States. You know, we don't have that sort of option here. You have to be standing up and saying things that are relevant, and you only get 5 minutes at a time to do it. So, yeah, there'll be a lot of troublemaking in the lawmaking process, but ultimately we've got a pretty clear agenda for people who want this law to pass. We're going to put up some very clear amendments that allow that to happen, and I think there's a good chance that it'll go through.
Now, that restriction you talked about, that'll get the Green Party over the line, but what about putting it to a referendum to ensure New Zealand First votes? Is that something that you're open to?
Yeah, so that's another amendment that New Zealand First intend to put up, and I'm completely open to it. We can have the debate, and there is a legitimate debate about, you know, whether a majority should get to decide the right of the minority of people who want it. You know, we can have an argument about whether, you know, it should be up to Parliament that's elected by the people or the people directly. We can have all those debates. But what I'm clear on is, number one, overwhelmingly a majority of New Zealanders want this choice. So I'm fairly confident that if New Zealanders got to have their say in a referendum, they would vote for the assisted dying law to pass. Number two, this is the right way to do a referendum. If you're going to have a referendum, Parliament should pass the law and then let the people decide whether or not it comes into effect or not. That's very different from when you ask the people in a referendum, then let the politicians interpret it, because as the British are finding, that can lead to some real disasters. In this case, politicians will have done their bit, and the people will get to say yes or no. And finally, but regardless of all the other arguments, if this is the way to get a majority of MPs in Parliament on side, so that those New Zealanders who are suffering can have some dignity and choice and compassion, then, you know, to borrow a phrase from one of my parliamentary colleagues, let's do this.
Are you concerned about narrowing the bill so much that it basically becomes discriminatory against some people that, that really should be able to access it?
I think that is a concern that we should be very worried about. But I don't think that that is going to happen with the amendments that are currently proposed. So, you know, getting rid of the grievous and irremediable condition, making it terminal only, yeah, there are certainly people, and some people who are very strong supporters of the bill, who, you know, admirably are still supporting it, even though it's not the way they would like it to be, even though there are people who are affected by conditions that, that would like to be able to have the choice of using it, but won't be able to the way that they hoped, and they're still supporting it. So, you know, that's great. It speaks to their character. But at the end of the day, you know, we got to get a bill done that can get a majority in Parliament and then pass a public referendum. And making it for people who are, you know, terminal within 6 months, that is still, you know, a very big amount of progress on where we are now, where, you know, people have to either just suffer to the bitter end or take less desirable courses of action.
During the second reading, a few MPs mentioned that they were concerned by how the select committee process had operated. What went wrong? Was it filibustering?
Well, I wouldn't call it filibustering, you know, exactly, but I think it's certainly true that certain members of that select committee took the attitude that they weren't there to be helpful. They said that the select committee shouldn't be able to make significant changes. It should only be able to do technical things to, you know, change around the drafting. Now, you know, in a way, I'm quite proud of how little got changed, because it showed that the bill that I introduced was pretty good, because after 16 months of the Ministry of Justice and the Ministry of Health officials and the public going over it, they didn't change a lot. On the other hand, there are some of these bigger questions about, you know, who exactly should be eligible, for instance, that, you know, clearly Parliament wants to see changed, and perhaps the public wants to see changed. And rather than addressing those policy questions, the committee restricted itself to purely technical matters. And I think that's a real shame. Because after 16 months, all that travel, you know, the select committee went to 14 different cities, unheard of. You know, if you're lucky, a select committee will travel to Auckland and Christchurch. Otherwise, you've got to go to Parliament to submit to a select committee. You know, all that time from the justice and the health officials, and they didn't grapple with the bigger issues that people wanted to see addressed. So I think it's a real shame, and it's a real shame that the same people who are on the select committee who didn't want to make any changes are now saying they're going to put up 120 amendments at the next committee stage because they want to improve the bill. Well, you know, I mean, that is frankly just dishonest. You know, there's people who are fundamentally opposed to this legislation for their own personal reasons and are trying to use every trick in the book to slow it down. But in the long run, so long as there's a majority for choice and compassion, then, you know, we're going to succeed, and all they will have done is waste their own and everyone else's time in the process.
Important social debates like this always attract some quite unfair arguments. One of them that seems to be coming through in this is that slippery slope idea. How do you argue against people that seem to think that suddenly people with diabetes are going to be able to end their life?
Well, I mean, first of all, that's just absolute rubbish. You know, diabetes is not a terminal illness. And it's not a grievous and irremediable condition that makes death reasonably foreseeable. So on no reading of the bill would you be able to use diabetes as a way to access assisted dying, even if you wanted to. And that's another thing people often forget. You know, the critical factor is whether the person actually wants it. and sometimes people miss that. So, you know, I mean, that's just crap. I think the important thing is that when we make arguments about what might happen, they are based in evidence of what's actually happened overseas, because people try to have this argument, like New Zealand is the first country in the world to do this, and they speculate all sorts of things that might happen. And what I always say to people is, okay, I understand you might have that concern, but let's look at what's happened overseas and whether anything like it has happened. And this whole slippery slope argument, the idea that it starts off as one thing and becomes another, well, you know, after 20 years, the foreign jurisdictions do not provide evidence for that.
And finally, although obviously, like you've said, this your bill was modelled in part on what's happened in Canada, there has been a couple of international experts, only a couple really, who have come out and sort of weighed into this debate. One from the UK said that he's surprised that this even made it to second reading. What do you say to international critics?
Well, I mean, I don't know why that guy says he's surprised or what his background is. I understand that that was somebody who had worked in the Parliamentary Service of the UK when they did an inquiry, and has subsequently gone off to be part of a sort of a euthanasia campaign group. So, you know, I suspect that what you've got there is somebody who is coming to the debate from a fairly, should we say, dogmatic preformed view. But look, I mean, the real answer is that if you do an analysis, and people should have a look at Matt Bicker's, Lucretia Seale's husband's, submission, where there's actually a comparison of the features of this bill versus the features of other bills overseas. This bill lines up as international best practice. I don't really know what else we can say to people who make these claims other than, you know, let's just keep going back to the evidence. How does it work overseas? What are the outcomes of the legislation they have in place? And how does this end-of-life choice bill compare with that? And whenever we go back and debate on those terms, we find that the end-of-life choice bill, comes up very favourably.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.